internet blackout in Iran is starting to be lifted. People watching from the outside can now see more of the deadly crackdown against Iranian protesters.
I really don't know how one continues to live in such a broken society.
I'm Carolyn Beeler, the latest on internet connectivity in Iran. Also today, the British government is looking to boost economic growth.
What business needs is confidence and certainty.
They're finding that in China. We will also hear about the rise and very public fall of the 80s R&B duo Milli Vanilli.
People were crushing CDs, they were setting them on fire, they were ripping up their concert tickets. Like, people were aggrieved. There were lawsuits over it.
At the Grammys this weekend, another chapter to that music story will be written. That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us on this Friday. We begin today in Beijing, where Chinese leader Xi Jinping hosted the British Prime Minister today. Keir Starmer is the first head of government from the UK to visit China in 8 years. Relations between the two countries have been strained recently following China's harsh crackdown on democracy advocates in Hong Kong and allegations of Chinese spying in the UK. But speaking in China's capital, Starmer said things with China are in a good, strong place. The Prime Minister's visit is bringing criticism from opposition lawmakers, human rights activists, and the American president. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
Keir Starmer arrived in Beijing with one clear focus for this visit.
It is in our national interest to engage with China. It's the second biggest economy in the world. If you take Hong Kong alongside China, it's our third biggest trading partner.
A full year of planning went into the trip, and Starmer came prepared, arriving with more than 50 business leaders, including bosses from HSBC Bank, British Airways, and Brompton.
So Brompton is the great British folding bicycle, the tiny little pocket rocket that turns your life from being dull and boring to being delightful, fun, and full of freedom.
Will Butler-Adams, CEO of Brompton, is talking to me from the British ambassador's residence in Beijing. This trip is a lot fancier than his usual visits, he says. He's been to China many times because the country is actually the biggest market for his folding bikes. But he's there this time, he says, because he wants to persuade other British companies to do business with China, especially as some global markets are no longer so reliable.
As we've discovered in the US, what business needs is confidence and certainty. When things are moving around and 1 minute tariffs are up, the next minute tariffs are down, you're not going to invest.
Yesterday, Keir Starmer and Chinese leader Xi Jinping sat down for face-to-face talks at the historic Great Hall of the People in Beijing. The Chinese leader said ties with Britain had gone through many twists and turns that didn't serve the interests of either side. Relations have been rocky under previous Conservative governments in the UK for more than a decade. This week, Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the Conservative Party, was asked if she would take a meeting with Xi Jinping if she were Prime Minister today.
No, not now, because I don't think that this is the time to do that. We need to be talking to those other countries who are worried about the threat China is posing to them. We should be talking more to those countries who are aligned with our interests, not the country that is doing everything it can to undermine our economy.
But some political experts say Badenoch's view of China is outdated.
We do have to remember that, you know, China is now a technology superpower. It's producing really important innovations in technology.
Kerry Brown is Professor of Chinese Studies at King's College London.
Our politicians in Britain and elsewhere don't really seem to understand the old world has gone where China was in technology deficit. It's now really pulling ahead. And we've got to work out how to respond to that.
The UK's economy is struggling and Starmer is under pressure to do something about it. But it's a delicate balancing act. Britain's biggest single country trading partner is still the United States. Last night, President Trump was asked what he makes of the UK's charm offensive with Beijing.
Well, it's very dangerous for them to do that. And it's even more dangerous, I think, for Canada to get into business with China.
Steve Tsang, director of the SOAS China Institute in London, says Trump's concerns are probably overblown.
It is highly unlikely that Starmer is going to get an enormous trade deal from China that will make Donald Trump very unhappy.
Still, for some in the UK, all this talk about improving relations with China is hard to stomach. Sebastian Lai's father, Jimmy Lai, has been in prison in Hong Kong for 5 years.
What has China given back? If it's a relationship, what's the is reciprocal? What have they reciprocated?
Jimmy Lai, the former media tycoon and outspoken critic of China's ruling Communist Party, is a British citizen. He was convicted last month of colluding with foreign forces under Hong Kong's controversial national security law. He's expected to spend the rest of his life in prison. Sebastian says his father has been in solitary confinement for more than 5 years.
It's a cell without a window, without any natural light. And he gets less than an hour of exercise a day. Already he had diabetes going into prison, having all these additional health issues, including, you know, heart issues, his nails falling off, his teeth rotting. It breaks my heart to say this as his son, but I honestly don't know how much longer my father has.
The British government has condemned Lai's conviction, and this week Prime Minister Starmer said he raised the issue of human rights with Xi Jinping. But Sebastian Lai says that's not enough.
If he returns without being able to, you know, secure my father's release, unfortunately, I think that would be a failure.
Today, Starmer announced that China has lifted sanctions on 6 British lawmakers, but there was no mention of Jimmy Lai. The UK Prime Minister also said that agreements have been reached on several issues, including visas for British visitors to China and lower tariffs on Scotch whisky. There's been no talk of a sweeping free trade deal, though. And China expert Steve Tsang says describing the visit as a reset of relations may be a bit of an overstatement.
The UK and China do not share basic interests. They accept that. And the fact that they ended the meeting between Xi Jinping and Starmer without issuing a joint statement would suggest that they could not even get that.
Still, Tsang says, after 8 years, it's good to see Britain and China back at the negotiating table. After all, he says, diplomacy isn't just for your friends and allies. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
It has been difficult to get much, if any, information out of Iran, but that is beginning to change. The Iranian government blocked internet access weeks ago as security forces carried out a deadly crackdown against nationwide anti-government protests. Mahsa Alimordani is monitoring the situation in Iran. She's with the nonprofit human rights group Witness, and she is based in London.
So what's interesting is since this past weekend, there has been a little bit of connectivity across the Iranian network. Of course, since January 8th, we saw the implementation of a widespread and lengthy national and near total internet shutdown, with also communication shutdowns. And after over 2 weeks, we saw some connectivity, but still the network is quite difficult and inconsistent. But some people have been able to make it online. And for the first time, many people were able to speak to their loved ones on, you know, encrypted and private communications as opposed to monitored landlines.
Do you have a sense of who is regaining access to the internet?
It's interesting because it's not entirely clear. So what I can speak to is the firsthand knowledge I have to people I'm speaking to, people I know, those around me in the diaspora are speaking to, as well as looking at some of the network connectivity data. You can see this on Cloudflare, it has some, and you can see the increase since this past weekend across the network, and it's very up and down, it's very low, and it's still nowhere near where it was before January 8th. But it is often very tech-savvy people who are, you know, switching between different virtual private networks. Mm. And there's been some random spurts of connection where someone I know called me without a VPN on one of the private messaging platforms.
What would be the reason that authorities in Iran are starting to open up access to the internet again, albeit very selectively?
It's really unclear. If you look at the network data where you saw an increase in connectivity basically from January 26th till today, you can see it's very up and down. The graph goes very high and then suddenly it dips. So it's very unclear what they're doing. They might be playing and trying to work out how to create these different levels of access across the network, as it is a sophisticated development of the shutdown from what we have seen from years before. So it could be that this interim period we're seeing of the up and downs could be them testing the network. But again, that's just a theory. I don't have a clear answer.
Mm. We are, of course, starting to see videos and pictures of what has happened in Iran emerging. How have people been able to get around the internet shutdown to post those?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. We're like entering these different phases for documentation efforts. So when the shutdown happened on the 8th, it was a very slow trickle because that window was really available through the Starlink connections that were there. And even speaking to some folks doing this documentation work, they were saying it's very clear because Starlink is so expensive and has so many hurdles that it is something that very privileged people have. So it's a very small window into the reality. Since this kind of connectivity on the network has been opening up, you know, this up and down trickle we've been seeing more documentation, even like footage from January 8th that we hadn't seen before of the way that the authorities were shooting into some of these massive crowds of protesters. And so I think you'll be seeing in these next few days, we've already been seeing the verification process and those numbers increasing.
If the internet were to be fully opened up again, would it be possible to get a fairly accurate count of the death toll just from videos and images, or is that something that might never fully be known?
It's a good question because the internet shutdown is just one mechanism of censorship they use in a whole array of different efforts. And of course, there is the physical coercion and the threats to the families, like being an Iranian in the diaspora, you know, firsthand or second degree connections who are, you know, families of the killed protesters. And we hear these stories of people not wanting to report or being silenced out of the fear, out of the conditions they've created. So there's that element of silencing that the regime also enacts.
Wow. We have been hearing on our program the voices of Iranians distraught because they cannot reach their families in Iran, Iranians in the diaspora. Now that there is a little bit of connectivity, what are you hearing from people about their personal communications?
It is very disheartening hearing firsthand some of the accounts and hearing the impact that this ordeal has had on people. I mean, just being in the diaspora and feeling the indirect impact and connection to such a horrific event that is unprecedented in Iranian history and I think unprecedented globally in terms of repression against protests. But just hearing firsthand the level of trauma of having seen what they have seen on the streets, watching city officials clean blood off of the floor. These are some of the conversations I had when I was able to talk to people on, you know, private encrypted lines. I really don't know how one continues to live in such a broken society.
It strikes me that the name of your organization, Witness, is very appropriate in this moment for the work you're doing. You are looking at those images and bearing witness as much as you can from outside of the place.
Yeah, I mean, it's more important than ever to have the ability to bear witness, to document the truth, and find ways to hold these crimes accountable. And hopefully all of these different efforts will be used to prosecute the criminals who have murdered Iranian people en masse one day.
Mahsa Alimordani is with the Global Human Rights Monitor Witness. She joined us from London. Some good news out of the Arctic Circle this week, if you are a polar bear, at least. The species has long been the poster child for climate doom. Researchers have predicted that melting sea ice would make it harder for them to find food. But a new study in Norway's Svalbard archipelago finds polar bears there, at least, are getting fatter. They are changing their eating habits, feasting more on reindeer, walrus, and seals, and munching on a new delicacy, bird eggs. Experts say the good news, though, could be fleeting because the Arctic is warming three times faster than the rest of the planet, putting more pressure on polar bears to adapt. This is The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Climbing Mount Everest is a dangerous endeavor. It is also more popular than ever. More than 1,000 people each year try to summit the world's highest peak. And that is a problem for what's considered the riskiest part of the climb, the Khumbu Icefall. The icefall has become so hazardous that a team of French and Nepali climbers are now establishing a new route on Everest that avoids it entirely. My co-host Marco Werman spoke with one member of the team, Antoine A. Route. He started by asking Antoine to describe the Khumbu Icefall.
We are talking about a glacier, and you have the highest blocks, very huge, very tall, something like a building of several story, which are moving due to the gravity and the temperature. And every day, this is changing.
Are you observing that the glacier is moving faster, and is that a function of climate change?
Definitely, but I would say the biggest problem is that the Nepalese authority increased the authorization and the release of permits to climb Everest every year. This means that you have more than 2,000 people on the mountain, which
is
very
a
risky.
Lot.
Exactly. So you have a huge quantity of people crossing this area. And this is the main objective, is to offer an alternative.
Yeah, so let's talk about the project you're working on, which is establishing this new route up the mountain from Nepal that avoids the Khumbu Icefall. What is different about this route? What's the path that this new route is going to take?
Yes, this route go beside the Khumbu Icefall. So we go around, we turn around the Khumbu Icefall, and we get access to the Khemkwan on the normal route. And this new route goes through a rocky part, and the idea is to install a kind of via ferrata, which is an Italian word to describe steel bars, a kind of steps, in order to ease the climbing by the porter, the Sherpa, a kind of plan B, you know?
Yeah, plan B. As you said, Antoine, in this project to map a new route up Everest, there are French climbers and, importantly, Nepali climbers involved in the project. French climbers, they travel to Everest and back to France. Nepali climbers, they live there and are often the guides or the Sherpas leading these climbing parties. Who is this new route really designed for?
Definitely Sherpas, porters. The route and the Everest in general allow many Nepalese in the region, in the Khumbu region, to work every year. This is their job and a very significant revenue or income source. Foreign climbers, of course, have to pay. This is quite expensive. This is a very challenging project for every kind of climber. We want to save life of everybody, but the priority is for Nepalese who are supposed to go through the Khumbu Icefall several times during the climbing season.
Yeah, and they're exposed to a lot more risk.
Exactly.
I mean, it seems really appropriate and relevant because I understand that almost a third of all deaths on Everest have been Sherpas.
Exactly, Marco. Of course, Nepal is exposed also to earthquake. And unfortunately, several years ago, during an earthquake event, 15 Sherpa lost their life in the Khumbu Icefall because of the falling of huge massive ice blocks on the way.
Oh, what a tragedy. Antoine, how do you actually come up with a new route up Everest? I mean, it's not like you can tell the GPS on your phone, show me alternative routes.
Well, actually, it was the idea of Marc Battard, the leader of the expedition, together with Speed Kaji, who is a very famous Sherpa in Nepal. First, in 2021, he did an helicopter flight trying to find a new route. And in 2022, he found the way. It was possible to have an alternative route. And since then, we are pushing to make it official. And hopefully this year, 2026, will be the year of finalizing this very important project.
You know, Antoine, every year it seems the pictures of lines of people climbing up Everest just surpass the lines from the year before. Are there too many people in the world climbing up Everest?
Yes. We need to consider that Everest has become very commercial. And unfortunately, due to the, I would say, the business around the mountain, and especially the Everest, we have people and experience, not even trained. And some of them never climb a mountain before going to Everest. But just because they have $50,000 or maybe $70,000 US to spend to take a picture on the summit, we expose many people to death. And this is the problem.
That was my co-host Marco Werman speaking with Antoine Ayroute, a mountaineer from Paris. He and a team of Nepali and French climbers are mapping a new route up Everest. There's a band called Group Shimshik that if you haven't listened to, give them a go. The frontwoman is the Turkish-German singer Derya Yildirim. She plays an electric saz. The saz is a long-necked stringed instrument common in traditional Turkish music, a genre here they are calling saz funk. It's a throwback to Turkish psychedelic music from the 60s. Group Shimshik is touring Europe right now, playing stuff from their newest album, which came out last year. They're in Australia this spring and the U.S. over the summer. Here's Yildirim translating the album name into English.
It's actually a question. Is Yarın Yoksa means if there is no tomorrow.
This is from a live studio performance at KEXP in Seattle.
There's so many things to do, actually, to save this world. It's a very central question, especially for our generation now, what's happening around us and who we becoming.
The Berlin-based band knows a thing or two about that. They come from all over the globe.
We build our own world where we can actually embrace us and be happy. We live in different places and having different lives. But when we come together, then that all doesn't matter somehow.
You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The International Criminal Court is where the very worst of global crimes are meant to be prosecuted. Experts, lawyers, and NGOs come together in The Hague in the Netherlands to seek justice in cases of crimes against humanity, genocide, and war crimes. But recently, the court has come under attack from the U.S. government. The Trump administration has put sanctions on some of the ICC's staff, making it difficult for them to do their work. They also face personal restrictions in their daily lives. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
When Francesca Albanese found out that she's been sanctioned by the U.S., she says she was shocked but not surprised.
It was very, very traumatizing for the entire family to come to terms with it.
Albanese, who's Italian, is a UN expert on human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories. She cooperates with the International Criminal Court in investigations into Israel's alleged crimes. Before the sanctions, Albanese was working on a report about a dozen private companies and their support for Israel's repression of the Palestinians.
I went after a number of businesses and financial institutions, big tech, corporations, including US-based ones, who had helped to fortify and to cement Israel's occupation. Of course, because I couldn't be challenged factually, I've been sanctioned.
Albanese has been threatened and accused of being anti-Semitic, which she denies. At a UN session back in October last year, Israel's representative Danny Danon dismissed Albanese's report and called it blood libel. He addressed her directly.
Ms. Albanese, you are a witch, and this report is another page in your spellbook.
In her position as a UN rapporteur, Albanese doesn't get paid for her work. That's the case with all others who serve in that position.
I don't do what I do out of activism. I just have a UN mandate.
Since being sanctioned by the US, Albanese says she's faced serious personal and professional repercussions.
For example, for any US person or anyone who has dealings with the US economic dealings, there are fines up to $1 million and arrest up to 20 years.
Banks and businesses can't work with her. Her assets in the US have been frozen. Booking hotels and flights has become difficult. Her daughter is an American citizen, and she says that has made things even more complicated. But Albanese is not the only one. President Trump has imposed sanctions on 11 judges and prosecutors at the International Criminal Court. Some have been working on alleged war crimes committed by Israel, others on alleged abuses committed by U.S. personnel in Afghanistan. I reached out to several of them for this report, but didn't hear back. The court itself didn't respond to my email either.
These are people attempting to impart justice. And to be told that that is a threat to U.S. security is deeply disturbing.
Margaret Satterthwaite is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers. She says this level of retribution by the U.S. on the court and its staff is unprecedented.
If you have a U.S. person, so that would be a U.S. citizen or someone who lives in the U.S. who is transacting with you, so that might be a family member who is a U.S. citizen or a family member who lives there. They themselves could face criminal charges or very high civil penalties.
This week, Satterthwaite issued a statement calling on the U.S. to withdraw its sanctions against the ICC staff. She says under international law, judges and prosecutors are immune from this kind of coercive measure.
It really sends a very chilling message to everyone who's trying to find peace and trying to say that law should prevail over might and the use of arms.
Several European countries have also spoken out against the measures by the U.S., including Finland, Denmark, and Germany. Anna Hathaway, who teaches international law at Yale University, says economic sanctions were created as a tool to go after the most horrific human rights violators.
What's so troubling about this moment is that the Trump administration is taking those tools that were meant to enforce international law and using them to undermine international law.
In the past, Americans have worked with the ICC to bring the case against Russia's President Vladimir Putin for the war in Ukraine. But now, she says, many are thinking twice about how much they can do business with the court without risking penalties.
One might disagree with various decisions that are being made at the court, but the way to deal with that is through the legal process, not through bringing sanctions. And I think this sets a real damaging precedent.
Trump issued the sanctions through executive orders, and he can easily lift them if he wants to, these experts tell me. Francesca Albanese, the Italian expert, says she has managed to find workarounds to protect those close to her. She says she will continue her work despite the sanctions.
I make sacrifices because I think that the cause for justice is more important.
But the time and energy she put into countering those sanctions, she says, could have been put towards pursuing accountability. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Living longer is an idea that has long held allure for humans. But aside from myths and trends, what are the facts about what actually leads to long lifespans? A new study published in the journal Science says longevity is even more dependent on genetics than we previously thought. Paola Sebastiani is a biostatistician at Tufts Medical Center. She told me this new finding is intuitive, but still significant.
I think it's really good news from my point of view, because we talk a lot about precision medicine, how we have to personalize the treatments and diet and physical activities to individuals. And the way to personalize it is through genetics, because many individuals, you know, everybody has his own personal genome. And so if we can understand what is the interaction between genes and the environment, we can really put a major development in treatment that are specific for each individual.
Interesting. So there are clinical applications here.
I think so. I think it's really important to understand. We know that, the diet that works for me does not work for you. Or the physical activity that some people can tolerate is not tolerable for other individuals. And so the more we know about how the genetics modify this intervention, the better off we are.
So you mentioned diet and exercise, which of course also both have an impact on our longevity. Are scientists beginning to think that those have less of an impact, though, than we previously thought?
No, I think it remains that it is a pretty well-established fact that diet, physical activity have an important role in longevity. It may be that if you think there is a 50% effect of the environment and a 50% effect of genes, as we start looking at living to older and older ages, maybe the effect of genetic becomes more dominant.
Mm.
But still, diet, the physical activity, social interaction, those are all very important.
Right. But you're saying that for those people who live to, an extreme old age, so 100 or older, genetics grows more and more important versus if we live to a more average age, like 85.
Yeah. Yes. And we have seen now we have strong evidence, for example, of some genes that are very well replicated, that individuals who carry these particular variants have a much better chances of living to old age. But it's also true that we don't fully understand how all these mechanisms work. It's a very difficult puzzle to resolve. So there are a lot of mysteries in genetics.
So many mysteries, so much to talk about here. We have been talking about lifespan, longevity. But that is not the only thing, we think about when we think about aging. We also think about how healthily we age, or what some people call the health span. How much of a role do genetics play there?
Actually, we start to understand that it plays a major role. And what we see is that many centenarians live healthy for a long portion of their life. This is not true for every centenarian, but many centenarians do this. And so we want to understand how you maximize your health span. I don't think there is, to me personally, any value in living a long, long life with a lot of disease. Like, why would you do that? But to understand how you can live long and healthy, that's a really important goal. And we have now evidence that genetics plays a role. So we show, for example, that there are some genes that are associated with the ability of people of maintaining good cognitive function as they age. So they maintain good memory, good executive function. So their cognition is good as they get older.
Mm-hmm.
And these are rare variations that happen in some families. And, the hope is that we can find more and more of such variations that are associated with the longer health span of people. Then the real question is, what do you do with this information? Because the genetics is not modifiable.
Right. No? I mean, these headlines raise the question of, well, if a lot of this is pre-written, does that mean I don't have to worry so much about diet and exercise? And does that mean there's less I can do to ensure a healthy life?
So discovering the genetic variants is the first step of the work. And then what we try to do is to understand what is the impact of these genetic variants on many biological functions. And if we understand this, then we can also start looking for intervention that allow people who don't have the good variants to have the same molecular profile. So the idea, for example, if you have high cholesterol, and having high cholesterol is typically genetically driven, if you have high cholesterol, then you take statin. Can we one day find treatments like statin who can help people to stay healthy for a long time? And these are extremely difficult questions, but I think it's really important to try to solve them.
I wonder if there's also environmental factors. How much does that impact longevity and health span? So aside from personal actions, but just kind of the environment you grow up in, is that a big determining factor?
I think that's a fascinating question. But I don't know that we have the data to understand this, because it is very hard to reconstruct the exposure to the environment in people who have lived 100 years. You have to go back to 100 years ago, and we don't know a lot. So, if we have more data from other countries in which there is a variety of exposure, lifestyle, environment. Maybe we can try to understand, try to get an answer to this question.
Paola Sebastiani is a biostatistician at Tufts Medical Center. She was not involved in the study on longevity published in Science. Now, I will admit it, I had never heard of the city of Oulu in Finland until this very morning. Maybe you had never heard of it either. Well, the place is about to get a lot more international attention. The old port city, nearly 380 miles north of Helsinki, has been picked by the European Union as one of two capitals of culture for the year 2026. The other is Trenčín in Slovakia. DW's Lars Bevanger paid a visit to Oulu to find out what's ahead for this former industrial city in northern Finland.
The Rele folk music group is one of more than 500 cultural organizations and creative professionals contributing to the over 3,000 events during Oulu's year as European Capital of Culture.
Every day there will be different kind of events, and we have some exhibitions which will be open all year long. So you can come to Oulu anytime and be sure that there will be interesting things to experience.
Pia Rantala-Korhonen is the CEO of Oulu 2026.
So how important has it been for you to anchor this in the local community, not just have a cultural program that visitors can come and experience, but actually make it an integrated part of Oulu and the region?
It's essential thing to make European Capital of Culture together with residents and communities and the enterprises, because without having the feeling that we are making this together, we can't engage people emotionally.
The city was once a global manufacturer of tar used on wooden ships, and much later it became one of the main hubs for mobile giant Nokia. Parts of the 2026 culture program will reflect this industrial past. For instance, the abandoned cellulose factory designed in 1931 by world-renowned architect Alvar Aalto, which is being restored and will serve as a venue. But the geopolitical realities in this part of Finland are also represented. Russia, once an occupying force here, is only a few hours' drive east. Ukraine and a possible path to peace is on many people's minds. One of the central art installations during Oulu 2026 is called Layers in the Peace Machine. Through the website peacemachine.eu, audiences around the world can share their own memories related to peace, which artist Ina Tajunlahti and Sara Henrika Mekinen then used to create a multimedia installation that will take over much of the Oulu City Hall.
Ja teos tutkii rauhaa jatkuvana vuorovaikutuksellisena.
Sara Henrika Mekinen explains that the installation explores peace as a continuous interactive process, and that she believes artists can help bring about a cultural shift in how we see peace by combining art and technology. Oulu 2026 CEO Pia Rantala-Korhonen agrees.
I think that culture and art can offer people different kind of opportunities to understand the concept of peace and conflicts. And I hope that people will find new ways to understand that we can disagree about many things and still we can live in peace. And we don't have weapons, but we have art and culture, and they bring people together. And when we put different kind of people together, it's a beginning of mutual understanding.
All right, so we are about 30 meters.
Now, because of Finland's history with Russia, every municipal building and every block of flats around the country is duty-bound by law to have a bomb shelter. This one I'm in right now is one of the largest in the whole of Finland. It's a car park right now, and of course, this is also a space that will be used in 2026.
Artist Jakob Kutz-Stensen will transform this underground architecture into a digital installation. Here's how he explains it in his own words on the Oulu Culture Capital official website.
And inside of there, there'll be different sound, different music, and there'll be this virtual world made with the botanical garden and the rivers and environments surrounding the city. Yeah, some kind of new cultural format coming together here. That's what excites me the most about the Cultural Capital project. It's not just my own artwork and being here, it's also participating and seeing like a whole city become something else.
Some Oulu 2026 events will likely appeal to an even wider audience, like the World Air Guitar Championships in August. I got a demonstration of the art from the 2025 winner, Aapo Rautio. Although it doesn't make for great radio, believe me, it's entertaining. But what of the lasting legacy once the European Culture Capital year is over? Well, according to several studies, host cities can expect increases in both visitors' numbers, employment and general GDP growth. Lars Bevanger in Oulu.
That story comes to us from our partners at the DW program Inside Europe. Listen to more of Deutsche Welle's work wherever you get your podcasts. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Grammy Music Awards are Sunday. One nominee from Germany has an extra reason to hope for a win, Fabrice Morvan. 3.5 decades ago, he had to give a Grammy back.
And the best new artist is Milli Vanilli.
Morvan was one half of the dreadlocked dancing duo called Milli Vanilli. Rob Paulides was the other half. Their debut album, Girl, You Know It's True, had 3 number-one hits in 1989, 3 of them. They had reached the pinnacle of pop stardom. What followed was one of music's most spectacular falls from grace. The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
In most pop songs, the chorus repeats, but at a live show in Bristol, Connecticut in 1989, Milli Vanilli did not have this in mind. In a video of the moment, the duo freezes as the pre-recorded song accidentally starts looping. Morvan looks like he's been shot. As for Paulides,
Rob freaked out and ran off stage and locked himself in his dressing room.
This is Gil Kaufman, a reporter for Billboard magazine. He's done extensive reporting on Milli Vanilli.
And downtown Julie Brown ran over and said, hey, you got to get back on stage. You can't do this.
Downtown Julie Brown was a famous VJ from MTV.
And he's like, no, we're ruined.
But it turns out people didn't care very much. Paulides went back out. They finished the show. Back then, lots of groups lip-synced live. In fact, weeks after the incident, Milli Vanilli won their Grammy. People up on music from the 1990s probably know this story, but for anyone who doesn't know Milli Vanilli...
Fabrice Morvan and Rob Paulides were a couple of guys who met in German clubs. They were aspiring singers and dancers who really wanted to be pop stars.
It was the late 1980s in Munich. News of the dancing duo eventually reached the ears of Frank Farian, a successful German producer.
He got wind of these guys because of their look. So they had these long, luxurious braids. And when Frank saw them, he was like, this is Milli Vanilli. And he decided that he was going to make them the face, but only the face.
Because Farian had already written and recorded Girl, You Know It's True with a bunch of studio musicians, including the vocals. He'd done this with other songs successfully. Most notably with a band called Boney M. a decade earlier. She's crazy about her daddy. The lead singer is faking it here.
The frontman for Boney M. was a go-go dancer.
Again, Gil Kaufman.
He could dance and he was real handsome, but couldn't sing a lick.
Boney M.'s frontman was apparently okay, moving his mouth with no sound coming out, but not Morvan and Paulides. They were hounding Farian to let them sing for real, even under a contract that expressly forbade it.
You know, they were pretty full of themselves at that point. They really believed, hey, we are superstars, legitimately. And so they said, if you don't let us sing on this next record, we're going to tell everybody the truth.
Cornered, Farian beat them to the punch. He held a press conference, told the world that not only were Rob and Fab lip-syncing, they hadn't even sung on the original recording. In other words, the Grammys' best new artists were frauds. So Grammys' Michael Green told them, give the prize back.
They may choose to give the Grammy to the second runner-up. They may choose to give the Grammy to no one this year. They just may say, best new artist, no Grammy given.
For the first and only time in the Grammy Awards' 65-year history, a group had their prize stripped. And that was just the beginning of Morvan and Pilatus' troubles, says Gil Kaufman.
People were crushing CDs. They were setting them on fire. They were ripping up their concert tickets. Like, people were aggrieved. There were lawsuits over it.
Rob Pilatus, who was already struggling with addiction and childhood trauma, spiraled. In 1998, he died from an accidental overdose. As for Morvan.
Chapter one. Dear Robert. Robert, I wish you were here so we could share this exchange in person, face to face, like we used to when we still believed the world was ours for the taking.
Morvan hung in there. This is him reading his memoir released last year. It's entitled, You Know It's True, The Real Story of Milli Vanilli. His voicing of the audiobook is what's earned Morvan a Grammy nomination this year.
For 35 years, I protected this part of the story. Locked it away behind a forced smile. Our dream of becoming rock stars wasn't the rescue we thought it would be. It only fed the void we both experienced. And the demons, they're fed on you. I know you tried to stop them, but the pain, God, the pain wouldn't loosen its grip. You were damaged, yes. But you weren't the only one. I was too.
Morvan's telling goes beyond the scandal, exploring the demons he mentions. Childhood abuse, abandonment, drugs, desperation.
I have already told my editor, if he wins a Grammy this time around, in my mind, that's the greatest redemption story in the history of the Grammys.
Billboard magazine's Gil Kaufman will be there Sunday night working and watching.
I mean, it's the strangest story in the history of the Grammys, but if he somehow wins for this audiobook about the scandal that got his Grammy taken away, you can't write a better Hollywood ending.
For Morvan, that word, ending, doesn't seem to figure in his version of the story, even at 56 years old. Turns out he's never given up on the childhood dream. He's been writing songs all this time, despite the ridicule, the eye rolls.
It really warms my heart to be here now. You know, I got four kids now, and I'm still working, still performing.
This was Morvan on tour in Germany in November.
A lot of people thought that I wouldn't be here today, but there's so much more to travel. For me, it feels like it's just the beginning, because eventually you're going to see my vision come to life, and then you'll be like, oh, wow, he said he had a vision.
Come on, girl, you know it's true. Sing it, everybody. Oh, 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 I love you. Come on. Yes, you know it's true.
Part of that vision is proving to the world that he can, in fact, sing, that he and Rob Pilatus could have pulled it off on that very first album. This is Morvan singing the song that brought him fame and ill fortune in his recent show in Germany, putting his real voice to the song he once faked. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
Girl, you know it's true. My love is for you. I'm in love with you. I'm in love with you, girl. Come on.
Well, you know it's true. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our channel there. It's called The World News GBH. I am Carolyn Beeler. Thank you very much for listening, and have yourself a great weekend.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.